Yes, yes. Americans think they know about American history. I mean, we all take American history classes in school, high school.
It's American.
We're American. Right. And we're taught what they want us to know.
No.
Yes. The assassination of Abraham Lincoln is something that everybody's taught about in school, but we're all pretty much taught that it was the lone nut.
Lone gunman, lone nut. It was Booth who did it, right?
That's right.
We all know that.
That's wrong. Wrong. We've got a gentleman who's got a book in the works. It'll be out shortly, and it takes a fresh look at the Lincoln assassination, which actually is not so fresh because people at the time had a pretty clear understanding of some of the other players involved in the assassination.
Are you saying that there was a
conspiracy?
They actually spun the truth?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, folks, Derek is right. We did this interview a few days back with Chuck Wilcox, and I'm telling you what, you're going
to
love it.
We welcome to our guest line in the bunker the author of The Transformation of the Republic, The Origins of the Religious Hijacking of the American Government, and The Truth Behind the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln, Mr. Charles T. Wilcox. Chuck, how are you today?
Not too bad, Derek. How are you?
He's alive.
Well, and for someone who's putting out the kind of information that he has collected, that's a good thing.
Yeah, Derek has been in shock over the last hour because he's spent the last couple of days reading your book. He, of course, works during the day, and I have the wonderful privilege of staying home and working from our home as a writer. And Derek has been trying to catch up. I read Chuck's really amazing book. Your book is fabulous, and I can't wait to talk about it in a minute. But Derek turned to me at one point and he said, I can't believe that nobody's been being taught this.
This is really eye-opening stuff. I mean, the quality of American public education aside, the fact is that there are some things that you have collected together in your book, which, when it's released, are really going to open some people's eyes.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's set the scene. What got you interested in this subject in the first place?
When it got
did you find out about the documents?
I mean, you have to go all the way. Like, I have a lot of relatives in the States, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I had cousins that came up in the 1970s, and we were roughly the same age. We were in our mid-teens, and I could not believe the quality of education that they were getting. They thought that, like, we had a cottage about 150 miles north of Toronto, and they thought that they were up somewhere close to Greenland. this was their extent of geography, and this is like in high school. Right?
Uh-huh.
And so that kind of got me to thinking. We started talking a little bit about history, and what they were being taught was like so far out in left field somewhere. It was insane. So anyway, I started doing a little digging on my own, and I found a few things on the Lincoln assassination and that and I mentioned it to him. Well, we've never heard that, Well, you should have. what are they teaching? It didn't make too much sense to me. So anyway, I decided, do some more digging. I'll see what I can come up with. And it took a long, long time, 10, 12 years. And then I was fortunate enough to, after talking to a few university professors and whatnot, that I got in touch with this one person in Northern Ontario who had just not too long previous been to see one of the last surviving relatives of Charles Chiniki. And she was, in her late 80s, and I guess she was kind of getting really, really sick and whatnot. But he had made arrangements to purchase from her or acquire all of this stuff that her family had in the basement. And it was like boxes and boxes, like 10,000 items of various things. And it took him like months and months and months to go through it and catalog it and scan it and everything like that. And among this material were sworn statements and private letters and that talking rather extensively about the Lincoln assassination. These are all first-hand accounts,
mm-hmm.
right? Several of the letters were from a person named Thomas Maley Harris, who is a member of the commission that tried the original Lincoln assassins. And he's going on his own private, like what he saw, but they weren't really allowed to bring up in the military tribunal, and basically saying that these guys were just hired guns. There was somebody way up at the top that was directing them and coaching them and mentoring them and all that stuff.
So conspiracy theory didn't begin with the Kennedy assassination. It began as far back as even Lincoln's.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then
they start talking about how the monarchies of Europe were involved and how they played throughout this whole thing. Yeah.
Well, backing up for just a second, my benefit, because I've only learned this name within the last few days, who was Charles Chiniki?
Charles Chiniki was a Roman Catholic priest who originally came from Kamouraska, Quebec, and he was honored by both the Quebec provincial government and the government in Ottawa for his work in temperance. What he did essentially was switch the ratio of pubs to schools. That was his big thing, and so I guess back then they had, for every school there were 9 pubs, and so he kind of reversed that.
Which explains why hockey is so popular in Canada today. I'm sorry.
That was one of his main claims. He was called the Temperance Apostle of Canada, but he was directed to go to Illinois, outside of Chicago, and establish a town, which he did, called St. Anne, which is a suburb of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
And then bring in all these immigrants and kind of populate. The ultimate goal was to populate the Mississippi Valley from essentially Chicago or like Illinois area all the way down to New Orleans.
Hmm. Now, when you say he was sent by his bishop?
He was sent by his church, ultimately, like from Rome to the bishop to him, the chain of command or whatever. And so off he went. And when he got there, though, he got into a bit of a problem because he was very much anti-alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the priests in Chicago, all being hard drinking Irish, didn't really appreciate the fact that he was kind of saying, well, you shouldn't do it, and all this stuff, right? So it got to the point where he was very much a stickler for scriptural truth. And he kept bringing this up to the bishop, and he kept preaching it from the pulpit. And a lot of Bible truth went directly against what the church was teaching.
Hmm.
And they didn't like that. So they said, he's going to ruin our religion if he keeps it up, right? So they tried to frame him. They almost got away with it. They had him charged with attempting to rape a parishioner, and it was... The victim apparently was the sister of one of these priests named Lavelle. Anyway, the bishop and a few of these priests got together and laid criminal charges against him. So Chiniki had to find a lawyer. Well, lo and behold, one of the lawyers of the defense team was Abraham Lincoln. And this is in 1856 or thereabouts,
mm-hmm.
and through that they became very good friends through that court case, because it lasted a good several months, and from there on in, Chiniki and Lincoln became very, very close friends, and Chiniki went to see Lincoln every year of the 4 years that Lincoln was president, to kind kind of warn them, you know, this is what I found out, this is what's going on, you need to be aware of, you know, this or that. There's a lot of assassination plots being cooked up against you, and so he opened Lincoln's eyes to a lot of things that were going on. When he combined that with what Samuel Morse was finding out about plots against the United States that had started way back in 1822 and were getting worse and worse and worse, then Lincoln had, you know, he's going, well, yeah, but he kept it to himself, really, because he was afraid, look, if this information ever got out, and the American people fully realized what the Civil War was really all about. And, you know, slavery was just a kind of a side issue, right? There were much, much bigger things coming mm-hmm. into play.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
That if the people ever found out, then the War of the Rebellion would turn into a religious war of extermination on both sides. And he didn't want that. So he kind of kept that to himself.
Now, I guess,
and only discussed it with his very, very closest friends.
I guess the obvious question would be, what would a priest from suburban Chicago, and I let's see, it was down around the Kankakee area for people in that neck of the woods to kind of identify where St. Anne is located, what would a priest from this small parish in what at the time had to be a rural area mm-hmm. know about assassination plots on the President of the United States?
Well, because he had a lot of friends in the priesthood, and the orders to assassinate Lincoln came ultimately straight out of Rome.
Whoa. You mean...
Yeah, you know, it's a heavy statement, but...
yeah, let's let that one hang there for a minute.
Well, let's back up again for just a moment, if you don't mind. You bring this up early in the book, and I would bet that many of our listeners out there, first of all, don't realize that this case was not truly solved, that it really is a genuine conspiracy, and that one of the big questions you bring up early in the book, and that is that there were people who literally learned of the assassination before it happened.
They knew about, well, yeah, they were co-conspirators.
And well, I mean the people out in
Minnesota.
In Minnesota,
yeah. There were priests in Minnesota that were discussing Lincoln and Seward's assassination as an accomplished fact days before it actually happened. They were so sure that their plans were going to succeed that they couldn't hold back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had to talk, you know, broadcast it all over the place. And it was, yeah, there was in St. Cloud and St. Joseph, Minnesota. I've got, like, actual sworn statements. These have the little seal on them and everything, saying that these are actual notarized sworn statements that are, you know, good in the court of law. They not only knew about it, but they were kind of involved indirectly in that. And they had gotten together, and a lot of them hung out in the house of Mary Surratt and cooked this whole thing up. So the word got around, you know, throughout the entire priesthood that this is coming down,
mm-hmm.
right? So it was a lot of people, you know, and in St. Cloud and St. Joseph, Minnesota, they say in the sworn statement there was, like, no rail, no telegraph for, like, 80 or 100 miles. You know, the only way they could get around was by, you know, stagecoach, I guess, or whatever, and all word of mouth. So you figure, how long did it take for that word of mouth to go from Washington, D.C. all the way out to the middle of, you know, nowhere, Minnesota?
Yeah, I mean, we need to remember that in the 1860s, Minnesota was considered just about the frontier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it had to have taken at least a couple of weeks. Right. And then a person who was a friend of John Surratt, one of the arch conspirators, his name was Henri de Saint-Marie, and he actually states bluntly in his sworn statement, which I quote entirely at the end of the book, that Booth and Surratt and Azarot and Payne and Harold, all those guys were nothing but a hired hit squad. and they were being directed, and he comes right, like bluntly comes right out and saying, these guys were being directed by their priestly mentors, and this whole plot was cooked up at least a couple of months prior to the event actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
They were just waiting for the right time and the right place to pull it off. And Lincoln was a target. Grant was a target. Seward was a target. Johnson was a target. You know, they wanted to completely wipe out the entire, you know, head of the government and leave it leaderless, caused so much dismay and problems it would prolong the Civil War, and ultimately the South would get what they wanted. And, I mean, this was kind of, you know, what they had in their mind when they went out to try to, you know, do all of this. But Lincoln was the only one that was actually killed. Seward was almost killed.
Mm-hmm.
Louis Paine, he stabbed the man like three or four times and left him for dead. And fortunately, you know, he survived and that. But,
it's very effective in opening your book the way you do with the information about the priest in Minnesota. You know, when Oliver Stone made the movie JFK, there's that little reference in there about the guy who sees the notice of JFK's death in New Zealand before the news could have gotten there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's always kind of like, well, did that really happen?
They really gloss over that fast.
Yeah, and they do kind of gloss over that fast. But you provide the sworn statements of men in Minnesota who state, in no uncertain terms, that I remember that this was on such and such a date before there was any way the information could possibly have reached them from Washington after the event. So
yeah.
it had to be, as you say, common knowledge among the priesthood there in this small town, and that the information therefore must have been, you know, throughout the community of Roman Catholic priests in the U.S. in 1865. Now, the question is, what was the purpose for eliminating the government of the northern states, the United States? I mean, what did the Vatican hope to gain? Or was it the Vatican or a group within the Vatican? Who in Rome was behind the plot, and what did they hope to gain?
Well, ultimately, there was Catholic monarchies of Europe, Austria, France, and Spain and whatnot. What they wanted to do, ultimately, was get back the lands that they had forfeited, right, in Louisiana Purchase, Florida,
mm-hmm.
and everything,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
what they wanted
to do was establish an ecclesiastical monarchy. Like they wanted to put a papal crown on the head of Jefferson Davis, and the Catholic religion would be the there would be no separation of church and state, anything like that. They wanted to completely destroy the Constitution because it was a big problem for them. They wanted to destroy bottom-up representative government. They wanted it all top-down. They wanted to establish a monarchy or a dictatorship or something along the something very autocratic. Right, and so they had Napoleon place Maximilian in Mexico. They put in like 10 or 15,000 French troops that were stationed on the Mexican border, and the Battle of Gettysburg had Lee actually won that battle, then you would have had all these French troops, all these crack French troops come up from Mexico, join up with Lee's army, march on Washington, and take the whole place over.
Huh.
So, that was the big picture. That's what they wanted, and you take a look at certain things that are happening now, and you go, well, have their goals really changed all that much? You know, you've got big issues on the power of the clergy in Washington now,
and you take a look at what's going on our borders right now. You look at Mexico, which is predominantly Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and there is a huge Aztlan movement, and There are. It's a porous border. It's a nothing border. It's just open. Come on in. The water's fine. And and the percentage of Catholics in the United States rises by the day.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to say this right now, folks. We are not in any way, shape, or form saying that we have any ill feelings toward Catholic people.
No.
You know, those who worship the Catholic, you know, hey, that's fine. We are not saying that. What we are saying, and I think you are saying, Chuck, is that there are those within the Catholic Church that have power-greedy minds.
Incredibly.
And
the people
incredibly,
in general have no idea.
And this goes way back.
Have in mind.
This goes way back even before Lincoln. This is this Jesuit thing's been going on for a long time.
Yeah. The people themselves, the laity, have they're being used as pawns.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
exactly.
They have no idea what their you know, ecclesiastical leaders ultimately have in mind.
Well, and by the same token, frankly, the United States, the citizens of the United States and citizens of many countries around the world have no idea what's really going on in their quote-unquote governments.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
You know, and the only time they ever find out is when they hand indictments down.
Yeah.
And usually that's not so much that there's a cleaning house, is that you've got different factions within the government who are gaining, you know, getting somebody on the other side.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got the Vatican then that is looking to place a monarch over the United States, and they're using the southern states to do that. Now, I was always under the impression...
Not only that, but they were also... That's kind of one of the things that Chiniki, he was bringing in tens and tens of thousands of Belgians and French Canadians into Illinois in order to pump up the numbers, as it were. And that way, you see, they can say, okay, well, when we go to the to the election polls, we can vote in our own people. And if we do that, then we can start passing laws to degrade the Constitution, to nullify the Bill of Rights, and we can do all kinds of things, as long as we have the numbers.
Boy, that sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Oh, well, wait a minute.
Isn't that going on now?
Do you think, and this is you know, a rabbit trail, but do you think that the potato famine in Ireland was then concocted to drive Irish out of Ireland and into the United States?
Yeah, I think that was a deliberate, yeah.
Huh.
Very much so.
Because clearly that played a big part of the makeup of New York City and Boston in the 1840s, 1850s. What was that, Oliver Stone? Was it Oliver Stone? No, it was Scorsese. Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
Well, he touches on a couple of things. He shows how Bishop Hughes was involved in the New York draft rising, but he just kind of touches on it to a degree.
Well, that was one of the things you brought up in the book that I wanted to mention, you know, showing maybe some of the other things that were going on behind the scenes. Besides just trying to, you know, kill the president, there were other things going on behind the scenes, weren't there?
Oh, many, yeah.
Now, what was behind it? What were the draft riots all about?
The draft riots were... Well, the draft riots occurred. The two things happened during that point at work. First of all, you had the Battle of Gettysburg, right?
And then
you had the Pope's letter going on. Letter to Jefferson Davis, basically acknowledging the legitimacy of the Southern Confederacy,
mm-hmm.
and putting the full weight of the papacy behind the cause of the Confederacy.
Which would make it very difficult for any practicing Catholic in the North.
Well, yeah, because essentially that letter said that Lincoln was a tyrant, that Lincoln was an apostate, that, you know, he was this and that. Don't listen to him, you know, you have to listen to us because, you know, God is on our side, kind of thing, right? Anyway, so, and then Lincoln found that he had to bring in the draft because, you know, the ranks of the North were being depleted now, so he had to institute the draft. And a lot of people that were kind of swept up in that draft were Irish Catholics, and Bishop Hughes said, well, we can't support Lincoln, you know, because the orders have just come out from Rome that you know, we have to support the other side, and, you know, so we're not going to support this draft, you know, and he was preached basically that forget the draft, you know, and all that stuff. If they try to force it, then we'll use, you know, insurrection and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So he essentially manufactured the draft riots. And then Meade had to, be, instead of chasing Lee, he had to divert full one-third of his army to go up to New York and stop the riots that Bishop Hughes had just kicked off.
A third of the Army of the Potomac was diverted?
Yeah.
I always thought that the reason that Meade didn't chase Lee was that Meade was just very conservative himself, was very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln had told Chinnicky, and Chinnicky records it in his book, 50 Years of the Church of Rome, that just shortly after that battle, there was an emissary or whatever that came into Meade's camp and spent like 10, 15 minutes or so with him and convinced him that, look, you got to go up to New York, right? And don't bother chasing after Lee, you know, let him escape. And Lee actually escaped with the loss of only two guns, right? His whole army could have been just, you know, swept up like in a fishnet or whatever. But
now, when you say emissary, do you mean representing Lincoln or representing the church?
Representing Rome. And so apparently it was a disguised Jesuit that had entered Meade's camp, had a little sit-down with Meade, and said, look, you know, your church is more important than your political work right now.
Okay, so Meade was a Roman Catholic?
Yeah.
Okay, I did not know that. That's not something your typical historian will bring out when discussing the battle. Well, you know, they're busy talking about the tactics and the strategy that was employed, that were mm-hmm. employed by the opposing generals. So this was around the 4th of July of 1863. That was that weekend, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th of mm-hmm. July 1863.
Yeah.
And then the draft riots were going on. Meade is talked to by someone, and then rather than chasing a beaten Southern Army, Confederate Army, he diverts a third of his forces to New York.
Yeah.
Leaving him under strength and not really in a position to chase after Lee and take on General Lee.
That's right.
Huh. Well.
Interesting, yeah.
Now, was it the arrival of Meade's troops in New York that put an end to the draft riots?
Actually, partially. Lincoln told Archbishop Hughes, look, you know, I mean, you're going to be shot as a traitor, right, if you don't stop this right now. And so Hughes actually gathered the parishioners, all the rioters, to his palace, called them his dear brothers and that, and told them, look, it's okay, it's all over now, you can go home, you know, peacefully, and you know, and that's exactly what they did, and so that's kind of how it was stopped.
So interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now let's see, where did I want to go from here? Boy, I made a whole bunch of notes.
Sorry, honey, your head's spinning.
Yeah. So how did the Pope officially recognized the Southern states with that letter that was sent to Jefferson Davis.
That's right. That letter was published in every single newspaper across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also published in various newspapers around the world.
Was it after that that some of the soldiers from the north, the Catholics, started deserting?
Pardon me?
Was it after that that a lot of the Catholic soldiers from the north started deserting?
General Harris, who after the war was in charge of the Veterans Pension Department, he had a list of how many people were comprised the Northern Army and then how many deserted after the publication of that letter. And out of 140 some odd thousand Irish not necessarily Irish Catholic, but Irish soldiers in the Northern Army, 104,000 of them, so 80% or better, deserted after the publication of that letter.
Oh, my goodness.
So that kind of shows you how much pull the church had at that time among, you know, their people. You know, I mean, really, they're going to threaten them, you know, like, if you don't do what we say, then you're going to go to hell, you know, or whatever.
Excommunication, yeah.
You know, and you're going to have to, you know, do penance for, you know, the rest of your life. I don't know, whatever, right? But, these threats and that, which the people really didn't take kindly to, and I guess we might as well do it.
Yeah, no, that's really unbelievable, because, again, that's not something that you hear about in history. I'm looking at the chart right now that you mentioned that General Harris put together, and the desertions among people who were born and raised in the United States were about 5% of the soldiers.
Yeah.
Of German immigrants who enlisted with the Northern Army, it was about 10%.
Yeah.
British, other than Irish, about 7%. Mm-hmm. And Irish Catholics who enlisted and then deserted, or were drafted and then deserted, 72%.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a fluke.
Huh. No. Huh.
So clearly there was influence there on the part of the Vatican to try to swing things in favor of the southern states. Now, the thing that, we'll get a little bit more into the actual details of the assassination and the conspirators, but the thing that I always wondered about, or the thing that I've been wondering about since we started talking about this, Chuck, the southern states never struck me as being particularly Catholic. I mean, most of the Roman Catholics in the U.S. were in the northern states, weren't they?
True, but a lot of their leaders of the southern states were.
Oh. Okay. Were, you know, educated at Catholic schools?
Well, Jefferson Davis, even though he was a Protestant, he was very nominal, and he was educated in Catholic schools. Beauregard was came out of a very distinguished family of Jesuits. Semmes was a devout Catholic. The higher ups, the big ones, they were all either trained and educated by Jesuits or devout. Romanists or whatever, you know. So they knew what their church, what the stance that their church took, and they tried everything in their power to fulfill their obligations, as it were.
Hmm.
But the armies, the actual, the poor little, pawns, minions, whatever, that, running around with no shoes and, ill-equipped and all that stuff, even though a lot of them are Protestant and that, they have no idea that, what the bigger play is going on here. They thought it was all for states' rights and that. Well, sort of. Right. That's only a half truth.
Sure.
You know, the bigger picture was, look, we want to establish not only our own country, but we want to establish a state religion, and we want to have a monarchy in place.
What was it tipped the scales? I mean, why take Lincoln out when they did?
Because in terms of time, it was after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was about 10 days after the surrender, so the war was over.
Close, but they were kind of hoping to kickstart the war again.
Oh.
And I mean, when you've got no leaders at the top making decisions in that, then, you've got anarchy all over the place. And then the South would have said, oh, here's our chance, to renege and whatnot. We'll start this war all over again, and maybe we can get what, But by that time, though, too, I don't know if that was really realistic on their part to think that, because they were, kind of depleted. Like I said, you had soldiers that were running around barefoot. They had no real industrial mm-hmm. capacity whatsoever.
Right.
Everything had been, burned to the ground by Sherman.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but this is, ultimately, this is what they still wanted to do. And, I can't remember what it was. Lost my train of thought there. But, yeah, that was what they ultimately what they wanted to do. And they say, if we can't do that, maybe we can have ourselves a nice little religious war, wipe out the Protestants, you know, and because a lot of the churches apparently were just stockpiled with weapons to hand out to the civilians to launch a religious massacre.
Oh, my goodness. Well, everybody thinks of John Wilkes Booth when they think of the Lincoln assassination, and we're going to find out what his connection is to the Jesuits in just a minute after we come back with a break to PID Radio. Don't go away.
Days, 50,000 words, the National Novel Writing Month, two novels, The Eridu Working by Derek P. Gilbert, There Came Darkness by Sharon King. For more information, please visit turnintodarkness.com or NaNoWriMo.com.
A forthcoming book, not yet available, but we'll tell you about that in a minute, but the book called The Transformation of the Republic, The Origins of the Religious Hijacking of the American Government and the Truth Behind the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Chuck, as Sharon mentioned just before the break, we wanted to get into some of the specifics now of the actual plot to kill Lincoln. We've all heard about John Wilkes Booth, and he sort of conforms to the lone gunman theory of history that seems to pop up every time a prominent person gets killed. Lincoln, lone nut. Kennedy, lone nut. RFK, lone nut. Martin Luther King, lone nut. Archduke Ferdinand, lone nut. You know, there just seems to be these lone nuts popping up all over the place. But
coincidental.
Yeah. But your research shows that there were more people involved and that there were very powerful people behind them. So who else was in on the plot besides Booth?
Well, there was John Surratt, and he was kind of the recruiter. He recruited John Booth, and John Booth, he was an actor, and he was big time. He was heavily into his craft. And that, but they got him involved with the Knights of the Golden Circle, and then through that, kind of got him bit by bit, swayed to, what they wanted to do, right? I mean, he wasn't really a strong character in that. He was big time into theatrics. Originally, the plan that they wanted to pull off was just to kidnap the president. He didn't want to kill anyone, you know, but then I guess he was talked into it over a period of time, and then he was given absolution right at the end to ease his conscience, and then went ahead and did it. But John Surratt, he was an interesting person. He actually, after this assassination, escaped to Canada, just outside of Montreal, and was tucked away in Saint-Laboire and Trois-Rivières by a couple of priests named Bourget and Lapierre. And they were doing this under the orders of their bishop. And their bishop was taking his orders directly from Rome, right? But anyway, they had him hidden out for the better part of a half a year. The U.S. government is looking all over for them, but they know. I mean, you're not going to start searching, priests' houses looking for this guy, right?
No. Why would the bishop? Was it in Trois-Rivières?
Yeah.
9 years of French in school. why would they care about this co-conspirator in the Lincoln assassination?
Well, I guess they knew that their church was behind it all. I mean, they had gone out and hired this hit squad. John Surratt had studied for the priesthood.
Oh, okay.
And Mary Surratt was a very devout Catholic. And actually, most of the team were Catholic. There was only a couple of them that were Protestant, but only nominally so. There was John Payne and Harold Atzerodt and Louis Payne, rather. Sessions. Okay. And Axelrod and Harold, Dave Harold, another guy named Ed Spangler.
Mm-hmm.
They all got, you know, and planned this out. And it was, you know, you got enough people and going through the logistics and how this is all going to happen. And they had to come up with alibis and escape routes and all this stuff, right? So it was very detailed and very involved. Anyway, John Surratt, you were asking about why the priests would want to hide him away. Well, because they knew their church was involved. They knew that they had to protect one of their own, right? The kitchen cabinet of the Confederacy was based in Montreal.
Right,
so,
okay.
So, you know, there was that connection. There were spies, Confederate spies, going to and coming from not just that area, but also from southern Ontario. So yeah, there were, all of this traffic's going on. So this is an escape. This is where he went. He was squirreled away by a couple of priests, and then they put him on a boat and sent him off to Liverpool. When he got to Liverpool, he went to the clearinghouse, like the oratory, of, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it was where all the priests, when they were going to and coming from Europe to the United States, they would go through this one place in Liverpool. Right, so that's where John Surratt went. And there he waited around, he got some money, and then he went to Italy, and he became a member of the Vatican Guard.
Now, that's a high honor. I thought you really had to be cleared at the highest level of security clearance for...
They had to be Swiss.
Well, yeah, not to mention Swiss.
Yeah. Well, it turned out, I don't know at that time, but yeah, that's what he did. And he went under the name of John Watson. And he eventually was caught. There was no extradition treaty with the Vatican and the United States. So they knew that the Vatican knew that they were looking for Surratt, right? And they knew very well that he's right there in Rome, and they're protecting him and that. So they figured, well, maybe we can preempt this and that. And so what they tried to do was say, okay, we'll hand him over to you, right? But they gave the guy advance notice. And they allowed him to escape, and they turned around to the United States and said, well, sorry, you know, we tried to hold him for you, but he got away. Wow. Oh, great, you know. The United States, they found out finally where he was headed, sent a gunboat from the Mediterranean to Alexandria, Egypt, and picked him up right when he was coming off the boat.
You know, he must have had some value to the church, to the those higher-ups in the church. Otherwise, they would have just taken him out.
Pardon me?
He must have had some value, continuing value, to the Jesuits who were behind it. Otherwise, why not just kill him?
Apparently so, yeah. But they were also, kill him. Well, he could have opened his mouth. I mean, but they wanted to make sure that they make the deal sweet enough for him that he won't, you know. And then he'll keep his mouth shut as to who really was directing not only himself but the rest of the team.
Well, again, Sharon's point, though, is that why protect him when it would have been easier to just, you know, dump him in the St. Lawrence River?
Just kill him.
I guess maybe they felt they had an obligation.
Well, I was wondering if they thought that somehow he was useful in leading a future insurrection.
He could have, I suppose, but he went around and gave lectures after that. And he was totally protected by his church. All of his lawyers were Catholic and that. And he was given protection right from the very, very top. He was given, you know, money and everything. And that's what they did. Instead of killing him to make sure that he keeps his mouth shut, maybe they did have other plans for him later on. I have no idea.
He was a pretty young guy, wasn't he?
At the time, I think he was 19. Yeah.
That is a lot of responsibility.
That is very, very young.
So they must have sensed that he was an exceptional talent.
Yeah, well, like I said, he had already, before the war started, he had already been taking training to go through the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
So Surratt served as the recruiter who brought these other guys in.
That's right. But he is the one that introduced them to the priests that were constantly at Mary Surratt's house.
Okay. Have those priests been identified, and what were their connections back to higher-ups? I mean, how far have you been able to trace the chain of command?
I've been able to trace it to the priests themselves. There was Wiggett and Stone Street and a few others, and I do mention they actually gave testimony on behalf of Surratt. During his trial, there was two of them. They both wound up with a hung jury. They were confessors to his mother, and then you had their friends and accomplices in Minnesota, and you know that these guys, they don't just go off on their own without some sort of direction from their superiors. It's very much a chain of command type thing. So if they went off, say, and concocted this assassination, like all everything that went in, without the authority of Rome, they would have not had too pleasant of an experience with their higher ups. Mm-hmm. Right? So they had to have done it with the full authority and knowledge of their ecclesiastical superiors in Rome.
You know, I've always thought that Mary, being a woman, I look at Mary Surratt and, you know, try to figure out why she was in it. I think it's really interesting that there's some evidence out there that she had an affair with her priest.
That wouldn't surprise.
Well,
yeah,
she had
given what's going on now. Yeah,
husband. And during the time that he, before he died, which he did, when before, you know, John got into adulthood, Mary apparently, they say, had an affair with this priest, and he was reassigned. And there are extant letters that are from Mary Surratt to him, and they just ooze. Something.
I'd love to get my hands on those letters. I'm put on the
They are available at the museum that's in her house.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna have to. Yeah. If I can ever make a.
I saw a documentary on it the other day. That's why it's fresh in my mind.
Or like on PBS or something?
You know, I think it was on the Discovery Channel. Mm. And strangely enough, it was one of those ghost things, and they were talking about why she haunts the place. And the woman who now is in charge of the house was reading from a couple of the letters.
Oh.
And they just, she very clearly had very strong feelings for this man, and she wrote to him and how much she missed him.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder if her son was targeted early on because he had an alcoholic, abusive father and a very impressionable mother who was devoted to the church.
Yeah.
And how much influence this particular priest, who was the object of her affections, might
exactly.
have influenced the plot.
Yeah, that's my tinfoil hat.
Okay, that's an interesting theory. That's an interesting thread.
That sounds a little bit more than theory to me.
Well
it's an interesting thread.
I'll let you pursue that, and then you can check back with me.
I mean, it's like right now I'm kind of living on a fixed income, and so when I get a chance, though, to go to Maryland, you know, or Washington and that, there's a few things I would love to be able to, you know, get more information and that.
Well, before
but, I mean, you do what you can with what you have.
I know.
Well, and again, we talk about tinfoil hat and theory, but the fact remains that you have the documented evidence, the sworn statements of people in Minnesota, a thousand miles away, who mm-hmm. were aware of this before it actually happened. So the mm-hmm. word was out there, so it's not theory to say that the plot was known by others.
Right.
That's right.
So,
this is hardcore fact. I've got letters that I quote from the Austrian archives. I've got letters and documents that I was able to acquire from the National Archives in Washington and the Library of Congress in Washington. But what I did was I hired people in these locales to do work. I told them, this is what I want. This is what I'm after. See what you can get, right? And so that's how I was able to get a lot of this information. Through the Chiniki archives, we talked a lot out on the phone and emails and that, and he donated all of this stuff to me. I thought that I was going to have to, try to save up,
Wow.
Purchase it and whatnot.
Yeah.
No. Here you go. He scanned everything for me on CD. And so some of it will be in the form of actual graphics. So you get to see the actual stuff and read the handwriting yourself. So much of it is transcribed from the original handwriting because some of it is a little difficult to read.
Sure. Yeah.
If you've only got it in a 6x9-inch page.
Yeah.
I've got newspaper articles and political cartoons from the period that I'll be putting in. A very, very well-rounded piece of work. What I really want to do is give the American people back their own history, because in my mind there is no greater theft than to be ripped off of your own history.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ultimate of theft, as far as I'm concerned. And you can't really, determine why things are happening now without going back to see, well, how did all this nonsense begin with?
Right.
And you put your finger on why we're not taught that in school.
Well, yeah.
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 Have these letters by Father Chiniki, between Chiniki and Lincoln, ever been made public before?
No. Never. I've got first rights to it.
Which, wow.
Yeah. He wanted to donate, after I get this printed and out there, he wanted to donate a lot of this material to the National Archives in Washington. But there have been people that have kind of said, well, if you do that, then because it is so inflammatory and that they might just bury it in a sub-basement in a back room somewhere.
right next to the architect.
No lights, and nobody will ever see it.
It would be analyzed by top men.
Yeah.
Hey, look, before we run out of time, Chuck, I would like to know. Now, you have mentioned there were other assassinations that took place during the 19th century.
Yeah.
Can you just touch on those?
Who was it? There was Taylor, I get those two confused.
Taylor.
Buchanan.
Yeah, Zachary Taylor.
Fillmore and those. They were all killed mostly by arsenic poisoning.
Now, can you explain that? The oath that they take?
Meaning the Jesuit priests?
Right.
Their oath basically boils down to the fact that they think that they have orders from God, basically, to infiltrate and subvert anything that they don't believe in. They believe in regicide as a remedy, and that regicide basically is the murder of heads of government, right? Monarchists, like monarch kings, queens, presidents, it doesn't matter, right? They believe that they have the authority to actually do this.
And they use either the cup, the knife, or the bullet?
That's their choice of weapons. The cup meaning poison, the knife, obviously, and the bullet. Straightforward. Or strangulating cord, any method of elimination that they can, cook up, then they will use it. They don't limit themselves to anything. In order to understand why these particular presidents were taken out, again, you'd have to go to the Treaty of Verona which is another, it's basically the blueprint that they were using, the Treaty of Verona, which was a ratification of Article 6 of the Congress of Vienna, which basically stated that representative government is anathema. Right, and they were afraid that what the United States had just got finished doing with their Revolutionary War and then coming out with the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, that posed a great big huge threat to their existence as monarchs, because if the people over there ever caught on with that idea, then their goose is cooked. And they didn't want that. And then the only help that they could really seriously expect was from the church. So I mean, because it was the church that told their parishioners, you know, basically to stay in line, honor the king as if he were, you know, God or whatever. And, yeah, so that's kind of the setup that they wanted. And these particular presidents thwarted those goals that the church had insofar as North America was concerned, and so much so that they felt that we have no choice but to get rid of them,
okay,
by hook or by crook.
So, yeah, most of us are taught that the first presidential assassination in U.S. history was Abraham Lincoln, but according to what you've documented here, we actually look back about 20 years to William Henry Harrison, who was a hero of the War of 1812, you know, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And in 1841, he lasted all of 35 days in the White House.
Yeah.
Now, and it was
because he came right out and said that government of the people, by the people, for the people is God's arrangement. And this other arrangement over in Europe with the church and that is totally not right. Well, you know, they didn't like that.
And plus, he was not going to annex Texas, which is something that they apparently wanted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And John Tyler, his vice president, said, yeah, sure, I'll do it.
Yeah.
And sure enough, 1845, Texas became part of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what amazes me is when Buchanan was killed.
Well, actually, he survived.
He survived.
Oh, that's right.
He was really
sick. Right.
He became so emaciated, he was never the same again.
Right.
And after that, it was sort of, whatever. I mean, he was very pliable after that.
Now, Buchanan was the president right before Lincoln.
Now, Buchanan is the one that was at a big banquet, right?
Right. Now, I've got the quote from your book here from the New York Post in 1857. And this is what amazed us when we read this. Is, and I'm quoting from the article from the New York Post that you quote in your book, Chuck. The article comes right out and says, President Buchanan was poisoned, and with great difficulty his life was saved. And it goes on to... it's very specific. It says that arsenic was sprinkled in the bowls containing the tea and lump sugar, which the northern people at the time, used to be northerners, that drank
iced tea,
and the southern men drank coffee.
Right.
And set on the table where the president was to sit. The pulverized sugar in the bowls used for coffee on the other tables was kept free from the poison. Not a single southern man was affected or harmed. 50 or 60 persons dined at the table that evening, and as nearly as can be learned, about 38 died from the effects of the poison. Why didn't we hear about this at school? I mean, 38 people eating dinner with the president, and he gets really sick. 38 people die.
Yeah.
I mean, my goodness, can you imagine what would happen today if you had a big state dinner and 38 people, the leading lights of the country, were just suddenly poisoned to death?
Yeah.
That would be huge news.
We'd have 3 months to 24/7
coverage. Oh, yeah. Fox News would love
it. I have no idea why they don't teach that in your schools. I mean,
well, I will say this. In defense of high school history teachers, they have a lot of ground to cover in a very short one semester class.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to be somewhat selective. But you're right, when it comes to college, there's no reason why the college classes shouldn't cover this. And my hope is that some of them at least do.
I took a college course on the American presidency, and I didn't hear any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, honey.
Our professor was busy talking about how you could learn a lot about the governing style of a particular president by analyzing his sex life. That's where he was going with the whole thing. So, and he had a good point, but it didn't help much when it came to history.
Was he taught by Freud?
Now, Zachary Taylor was another president before Lincoln who was assassinated. Zachary Taylor was a hero of the Mexican War. He was elected in 1850 or 48, maybe 48.
Mm-hmm.
But he died in 1850, 4th of July weekend. This is interesting because it was 4th of July, and it was at the Washington Monument.
Very symbolic.
Yes, yes. The big Masonic, describe what it is there. But he was poisoned at the 4th of July. But
he was.
No, they serve hot dogs here.
But Zachary Taylor was poisoned because he was not a pro-slavery man, even though he was a slave owner himself.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to note that his vice president, who he didn't choose, you know, it was almost like a Reagan George H.W. Walker sort of thing. You know, he got stuck with a guy that he didn't like.
George H.W. Bush.
Right. George H.W. Bush.
Yeah.
Millard Fillmore was his vice president, and Fillmore was very pro-slavery.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And so they got Taylor out of the way, and they got their pro-slavery president into office.
Yeah.
Well, bringing this into the present, since you mentioned George H.W. Bush, I think it's interesting that, and you bring this up in your book, Chuck, that President Reagan was the one who, the first one in a long time, that recognized the Vatican.
Yeah, well, right after Lincoln's assassination, it was common knowledge. That's what kills me, that why it's not taught. Anyway, at that time, it was common knowledge that the church had a leading role in that assassination, and not only that, but basically engineer and tweaking the Civil War for their own purposes. And they cut off all diplomatic ties to the Vatican right after that. And Reagan was the first one since 1867 to reestablish diplomatic ties.
That is interesting. And again, Reagan was not a Roman Catholic. He was a nominal evangelical Christian.
You think so?
Well, he claimed to was.
Nominal meaning in name.
For the world.
Depending on his star chart for the day.
Anybody that engages in seances and
astrology,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. That's why I said nominal, meaning in name only. That's really bizarre. The one thing I wanted to ask, we've kind of seen the work of the hand of the Vatican here in kind of broad strokes over the last hour. Why is it, how do we come to identify the Jesuits as the ones executing the plot?
Because that's where the documentation takes us.
Okay. So it's identified that the Jesuit, that the priests who were involved in helping Surratt, for example, that were members of the Jesuit order?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are they sort of like, historically, are they sort of like the enforcement arm of the Vatican?
Yeah, they are the Gestapo of the Catholic Church. For all intents and purposes, if you read the oath and take a good hard look at that, they are a military order. They wear religious costumes, but they are, for all intents and purposes, a military, like the warrior priests, monks and whatnot that engage in actual warfare.
So
they believe in infiltration and subversion and elimination, all that stuff.
So the Jesuit universities around the world are like fortresses?
For all intents and purposes.
Or military.
Samuel Morris gave a really, really good analogy of how that system compares to, he uses the Russian aristocracy as an example. He says, if Russia came in, for instance, and said that they were going to lay claim to the United States, and they were going to bring in their emissaries, they were going to elect, their own politicians, they were going to educate the people to pull the loyalty of Americans and pull that away and make them loyal to the Russian Tsar and all that stuff, what would we at first think of a claim, of that type of a goal? Obviously we kind of laugh, right? But what if he actually started to get away with it?
Mm-hmm.
Brought over his emissaries under the guise of, educating them, and then was bold enough to eventually try his hand in the elections and on and on and on. What's the difference, really, between what Romanism has done and what... The the theoretical Russian monarchy, whatever. There is no difference. There's only difference in name.
Hmm. And interesting that, again, that this religious aspect to the history of the Civil War and American history in general is just not even a consideration when we're taught history in school.
No, you know, and I think that frankly, I think history is taught in a way that is intentionally boring. Because seriously, if you can keep a person from really knowing history, you can keep that person pretty stupid.
Well, unless you start actually going out and doing your own. I mean, the internet is an incredibly good tool, you know, for getting the straight goods. But I mean, even when I was going to school in high school, like grade 9 all the way to 12, a lot of that is really nothing new. Like, to me, anyway, I mean, but if you start talking about Jesuits' subversion of countries throughout their history, you know, going to Japan and getting the ear of the emperor and taking over the government of Japan, you know, like they kind of touch on a little bit in programs like Shogun or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in our high school, we're taught all of that stuff, right? But in the States, they're not for some reason.
No, well, political correctness or what have you, or influence on curriculum.
I mean, come on, well be. They've been trying to take over our country.
Yeah.
You really think they're going to let that be taught?
Yeah, and now
we're in a situation where we have, for all intents and purposes, a 21st century version of the Crusades of the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
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 Right.
And that's a whole other show. That's a whole other show. But you're right. There are some very strong parallels.
So the question then becomes, well, this didn't happen overnight.
No.
Right? So how did all of this get to be that they're in a position like that now?
Right.
Yep.
Right. And we'll have to have you back because we need to talk about all that.
Yeah, how that is being played out today. So the book is in the works, Chuck, The Transformation of the Republic. How soon do you think you're going to be able to have this available?
Hopefully by the end of this month. I am just, everything's put together now. I am just waiting for a friend of mine with a computer that can help me insert the graphics properly, make sure that they're readable, then we're going to put it all together, take it to the printer, within a couple of days I should have a hard copy. I'm aiming for the end of this month.
Okay, so the end of November.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Those out there, and I know you're chomping at the bit to get this book, keep checking back at PID Radio and watch your magazine, and we will, as soon as we have that information, we will have a link to the place to buy it online. In the meanwhile, is there a way to get in contact with you, Chuck, if they just want to ask you some questions?
Sure. My email address is Veracity, that's Veracity, at nucleus.com.
Veracity@nucleus.com. We'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, and we'll look forward to seeing the hard copy of this book. We've been blessed with the advance copies, and it's fascinating reading, seeing the plot laid out, not in Chuck's words necessarily, but in the words of the men and women who were there and saw it with their own eyes, including this brand new, well, at least new to historians and new to the public, information from the Chinookay collection. That's excellent work, Chuck, and we appreciate it.
It's a great book. You do a really wonderful job of presenting the actual documents and then drawing conclusions and writing in a way that is really approachable. This book is a fascinating read.
Yeah. I mean, the Lincoln assassination has been covered so many times and analyzed so many ways that coming up with a new perspective on it is very difficult, but we think you pulled it off.
Yeah. We think you should watch your back.
Yeah. Chuck Wilcox, the author of The Transformation of the Republic, The Origins of the Religious Hijacking of the American Government, and the Truth Behind the Assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Thanks for being our guest on PID Radio.
Thanks, Chuck. God bless you, sir.
You too.
You know, my conspiracy hat, my tinfoil hat, is just kind of to the side now. It's just kind of sitting
not
on the side of my head. It's been knocked askew.
Well, you know, there was that MIT study that we posted at WatcherMagazine.com this past week that showed that the foil hat actually amplifies certain radio frequencies which have been allocated to the United States government.
This is a scientific study, and
yes.
I know scientific when I see it.
Sharon has done much science in her life.
And much of it good.
Well, we're
thankful. They studied every type of tinfoil hat.
Well, three different configurations.
Basic.
Yeah, the skull cap.
Uh-huh.
The
which
fez.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Oh, the fez. It was a fetching fez configuration.
Yeah.
And
then, of course, there was the gladiator, which had this sort of the central crest, you know, looked sort of Spartan, ancient Greece look to it. That was an interesting look, but they found that even though it did block certain radio frequencies, the ones the government uses tend to be amplified.
The only thing that was not in that article, did they do it shiny side out or shiny side in? Because that's important.
I'm sure it makes a difference.
It makes a huge difference,
yeah.
And I'm going to try mine shiny side in next week when we do our Connect the Dots, the PIDCTD episode.
Yes, Sharon and I are going to take a look at some of the things in the news that have been under or unreported by the mainstream media, as if that's a surprise, and connect some dots that are pretty disturbing.
Yeah, I'll give you a teaser. Between now and next week's PID radio episode, Google choice point. All one word, choice point.
Yeah.
And if you want to put another search term in there, Marvin Bush.
Yeah. And you'll see some connections that have popped up that should make you think twice about, well, everything you hear on the news. Because none of it is really as important as the stuff that they're not talking about.
That's right. So. Everything you've learned is wrong.
Yes.
That's what Derek's new book is going to be called.
Speaking of books, National Novel Writing Month continues. I'm at about 6,000 words as of today. Sharon's at about 30,000.
I've reached blithering idiot stage.
Yeah, I'm not quite blithering, but I have changed the title and the focus of the book already, so...
Oh, I'm splitting mine up into two books now. My characters have totally taken over. It's a riot. It's just no good anymore. I'm just going to have to kill off everybody.
So that's what we're working on. This coming week, we are actually getting several opportunities to take... some of our interesting discoveries to the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon, now by the time you hear this will probably already have passed by, but Sharon will be on the Power Hour with Joyce Riley and Dave Von Kleist
Monday morning the 14th.
Yep.
And from 8 to 10 Central Time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 8 to 9 and maybe 8 to 10. And then on Wednesday, the 16th,
You'll be with Frank Whalen of Frank Whalen. Is Speaking Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
And Friday, you will be on with...
Joyce and Dave on the Power Hour. Friday morning, that'll be between 8 and 9, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Central Time, again, that's Greenwich Mean Time, minus 6, for those of you overseas. Those shows are streamed live on the Internet. We'll post links to that. And then Friday night, our favorite guy, our favorite radio host, Visigoth.
That's right, the Viz.
From the Grassy Knoll, we'll be with Viz on the Grassy Knoll at 11 o'clock Central Time. And... discussing just some of the more esoteric features of things in the news.
Murphy may even make an appearance. You never know.
Yeah, yeah.
He's usually asleep by then, but...
Yeah, well, he and Chuck Wilcox's cat had a nice discussion while we were interviewing. So we appreciate you tuning in and listening, and as always, we'll put all the links to things we discuss in today's show in the show notes.
And as always, if you want to send us a note, radio@peeringintodarkness.com. We are so happy to hear from everybody, and come join us on the forum.
Yes, peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Forum.
But